This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Negotiating on a new treaty, a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, allows us to create a global just transition plan, allows us to help countries so that they're not pushing their economies deeper into the hands of the oil and gas industry at this moment in history, because the fact is we have the solutions. We have the technology.
Those who attended the 25th annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP25, in Madrid this past week were hopeful that it would deepen the commitment of the world's largest greenhouse gas-emitting nations to fighting climate change. Unfortunately, attendees left Spain disappointed. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Zipporah Berman, the International Program Manager for Stand.Earth, who attended the conference. Berman provides insight into why the conference broke down, what it means for the climate change movement, and how the 2020 U.S. election will influence next year's summit in Glasgow, Scotland. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Zipporah Berman. She's an International Program Director for Stand.Earth. Zipporah, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
So you just got back from COP25 in Madrid. For our listeners who aren't familiar with these annual conferences, why don't you kind of tell us what they mean for the climate change movement, and then we'll dive into the details of this particular one, the 25th.
Sure. These conferences are put on by the United Nations every year for the past 25 years to essentially negotiate the rules around the space left in the atmosphere. What one thing that we know for sure is that the amount of space that can hold carbon in the atmosphere is finite. And the more that is trapped up there is smothering the Earth and creating a kind of blanket that's changing our climate. And so these conferences are for parties to negotiate who gets to pollute what and how we manage that. This one was pretty important because it was negotiations around how to be more ambitious, given that the science is a lot worse than we thought it was going to be. And in fact, people are experiencing more devastating impacts of extreme weather, et cetera, definitely in greater numbers than the scientists thought at this point in history. So negotiators were supposed to deliver increased ambition, financing for climate vulnerable countries, and also strong rules for carbon markets. So that we could safeguard human rights and the rights of indigenous peoples and not do double counting, but that countries could trade how much they were allowed to pollute, basically. And almost none of that worked.
And how does the framework of the Paris Agreement play into negotiations with COP25, most notably the U.S.'s withdrawal from the agreement?
Well, U.S. negotiators were still there, and in fact, they held back a lot of the agreements around some of the pieces that I just mentioned. But it definitely, the U.S. saying that they're leaving creates a kind of pall over the conversation. It creates an urgency. But let's remember that this agreement is it's not legally binding. And so what the agreement is countries saying what they're going to do. We also have annual accounting, the emissions gap report, which kind of says how are we doing? And all of these issues are influenced a lot by what financial markets do and what the big banks do. And so it's not, even with the U.S. saying that they're leaving, what's kind of in a lot of ways is more important is what's happening to U.S. emissions, what's happening on financing in the U.S., and also what states and cities are doing. I mean, most of our pollution is in cities. So, you know, Trump can grandstand all he wants. But the fact is that subnationals are moving. Look at California, and so are cities. And so even though the U.S. is saying that they are leaving, we can still make a lot of progress.
So maybe you can summarize the takeaways from this conference. It seems pretty negative in general that the toughest issues weren't resolved. Is that a fair assessment?
On every major issue of significance, COP25 delivered either a mediocre or a non-outcome. And that's actually pretty scary, given what we're experiencing around the world. It was a bizarre experience to be at COP and walking the halls and hearing scientists and leaders of some of the most vulnerable nations saying that we are in a crisis, that millions are already impacted, hundreds of thousands have lost their lives, and then to go into the negotiating room and hear them arguing about Article 6 point blah, blah, blah. You know, so no, we didn't get strong outcomes at COP25. And, what we're facing, we learned, is much more significant than anyone thought.
And how many of these have you been to? And give us kind of a context of how this would rank in terms of its disappointment.
I have been to 10, been going to COPs for 10 years. Probably I've attended 8 of them. And no one expected massive breakthroughs here. It wasn't like there was a main negotiating text like at Paris. But I think in some ways that's why it's so disappointing, because it feels like, really? We can't even agree to these rules that we're trying to create on financing and carbon markets when millions are marching in the streets and it's way worse than we thought. And so I would say this is right up there with major disappointments with Copenhagen, which was kind of the 2008 COP where everyone thought we'd make a massive breakthrough, and instead it was a massive breakdown.
I'm curious if COP24 lacked the U.S. leadership in terms of actually negotiating these agreements, or if it was just the vibe wasn't exactly more optimistic since the largest emitter in the world is not on board.
These negotiations failed last week because of 3 countries: the United States, Brazil, and Australia. And what's really notable about those 3 countries is that all of them have significant oil and gas expansion planned within the next 5 years. So I think what we saw at COP25 is not just a weakened U.S. position as a result of Trump, but the power of the fossil fuel industry, in particular big oil, who are trying to keep access for as long as they can to expanding the production of oil and gas. They're holding our international negotiations hostage. They're holding climate policy in several major countries hostage. And that's what we saw last week in Madrid.
Now, the Brazilian case and the United States case, I can understand because they have these hardline right-wingers in Bolsonaro and Trump. But is Scott Morrison a climate change denier? Maybe you can kind of expand on Australia dropping the ball here. They're not a country that denies science, right?
No, they're not. And neither is Canada. Neither, especially, is Norway. But what you see from all of those countries is that even when you get a progressive administration like the Trudeau administration in Canada, who believe in climate change, who are putting a price on carbon, who are phasing out coal plants, they can't get out from under the oil and gas industry. And that was the fascinating thing at this COP, is that literally for 30 years we've been discussing climate change and negotiating about emissions, in large part because of this annual report that comes out called the Emissions Gap Report that adds up how much pollution is happening around the world. Right before COP, the United Nations released a new report with Stockholm Environment Institute called the Production Gap Report. And what it showed is that while the world has been focused on emissions and reducing emissions, literally behind our backs, the oil and gas industry and the coal industry have been planning a massive expansion of production. The Production Gap Report shows that we're on track to produce 120% more fossil fuels than the world can safely burn in a 1.5 degree scenario. So we're making all these agreements to reduce emissions, but what's happening is the industry is planning to massively expand. And if you look at the countries that are bulking, it's the countries where that oil and gas expansion is seen to be critical to the development of their economy, where they've got really big projects. And the worst player, the United States, 70% of global oil and gas expansion over the next 5 years is planned in the United States in two states, New Mexico and Texas, 70%.
The wine beneath the bed, the things we done and said, and all the memories that come glancing back to me in my loneliness, standing in the breach, the arm that stretched but out of reach, and consciousness has found me sometimes wondering where you're at. Take me back again, take me back one more time, Spanish Road.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Zipporah Berman. She's the International Program Director at Stand.Earth. So, Zipporah, what were some of the specific goals for the climate summit, the COP25? And take us back 2 or 3 weeks, and what were you expecting or hopeful would be passed while you were flying to Madrid, and now that you're back? Where are the specifics that dishearten you?
Well, I think the most important things that people thought would be negotiated in Madrid were more ambitious emissions targets. We're coming up to the 2020 deadline, when it's a moment to take stock, when countries are supposed to be increasing their ambition. Financing for climate vulnerable countries is really critical. And then the other major and probably the primary thing being discussed at COP25 was this question of Article 6. Article 6 was supposed to deliver strong rules for carbon markets that would uphold the integrity of the Paris Agreement, but also safeguard human rights and the rights of indigenous peoples. The idea is basically that countries can trade how much they're allowed to pollute, and that can mean the quickest reductions and the cheapest and most effective reductions, or at least that's the idea. The problem is, in practice, there's a huge fear that there's going to be double counting, that there's going to be a lot of fake credits. I mean, the gas industry was there arguing that liquid natural gas from fracking should get a credit because it's cleaner than coal. There's so much wrong in that statement, it's hard to even unpack. And the fact is, it's still a fossil fuel. It's a result of fracking, which we now know has a massive carbon footprint and methane footprint. And at this moment in history, we actually can't afford to be expanding gas. And gas is mostly competing with renewables in China. It's not displacing coal. It may be displacing renewables as well. So the fossil fuel industry was trying to kind of warp it.
And how did that proposal get met by negotiators? Was it passed?
Well, no, the fact is nothing was passed on Article 6 because they couldn't get agreement, because there were a number of major countries that held their ground and said, look, these are the rules that we had agreed to and the principles that we had agreed to. And then there were a number of countries who are heavily influenced by the oil and gas industry that dug in their heels. And so Article 6 was punted to next year, the COP26, which will be in Glasgow. And in some ways that's really good, because if an agreement had been pushed at this COP, it would have been a terrible agreement.
So when you mention the oil and gas industry's influence here, is it merely by proxy, or do they have a seat at the table at these conferences?
Well, what's interesting about the oil and gas industry and their role in the climate negotiations is that if you look at other major negotiations and treaties, think tobacco, for example, the tobacco industry is not allowed to be there. But in this case, the oil and gas industry is allowed to be there, and they're all over it. So there are representatives from, I bumped into a representative from the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. There are representatives from Shell. There are, you know, major oil companies and oil and gas associations are allowed.
And are they sponsors as well?
Well, there were definitely fossil fuel industry sponsors, yes. And sometimes you have individuals who worked for or still work for the industry who are on country delegations. But even if they're not, what you see when you crosswalk the positions of particular countries, the U.S., Australia, Brazil, is almost identical to the position papers of the oil and gas industry. And you know what's really interesting? When I first started researching this years ago,
what?
I grabbed the Paris Accord and I thought, I want to understand, what does it say about oil and gas? So I did a search through the Paris Accord, thousands of pages, and the words oil and gas don't appear. I thought, that's kind of crazy. So then I searched for coal. Nope. Coal doesn't appear. Then I searched for fossil fuels. The words oil, gas, coal, or fossil fuels don't even exist in the Paris Accord. Yet we know that fossil fuels are 70% of global emissions. So I started calling around and talking to experts around the world. And what I found, I think, is systemic. It's kind of like what we realizing that Exxon knew in the 70s, but, you know, tried to hide the evidence and create doubt. For decades, the oil and gas industry has been lobbying behind the scenes and sometimes right at the table to try and shift the conversation. So it doesn't all constrain the production of fossil fuels, but that instead it focuses on emissions, and that baked into all of these scenarios for how we should address climate change are these technological unicorns that allow emissions to be high and therefore production to be high.
So when you're reading through the Paris Agreement and not seeing references to fossil fuels and oil and gas and coal, which is pretty mind-numbing, right? How has the oil and gas industry kind of had their hand on the scales of justice, if you will, in terms of baking in their language into these agreements, in your estimation?
I think what's really shocking when you start digging deep into how are we assessing how much pollution is okay, what are the levels that will reduce the impacts that we're already seeing, the fires and the floods, etc. You see the hand of the oil and gas industry. And the biggest example is in how these different assessments, the International Energy Association assessments, or even the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessments, how much they include evaluations of technologies that we might use to reduce pollution from fossil fuels. And so there are two areas. One is called CCS, which is carbon capture and storage. So the industry gets to keep producing, but they put in place this technology, which sucks the carbon and stores it in the ground. And the other is called BECCS, which basically stands for land use carbon capture and storage. So what I found out is that all of the scenarios that our governments are using to say, yes, this is in line with a safe climate, or yes, this is in line with Paris, that the industry likes, all the assessments around the world include a huge amount of these two technologies. So let me give you one example. In the assessment that everybody uses for how to keep below 2 degrees, there's the BECCS levels that are baked in would mean that every year, in order to allow that much pollution, we would have to plant grass on an area twice the size of the landmass of India. Then we would have to cut it down. Then we would have to burn it, capture the smoke, and put the pollution underground. And that scenario is in, for example, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change about keeping us below 2 degrees. That's crazy. We don't do any of that now, let alone an area to the size of India. And these scenarios that we're going to capture carbon from the air, and that therefore it's okay to continue expanding the production and burning of fossil fuels underlie all the assessments that we're negotiating right now around the world.
I guess a listener at home has to wonder, who's more powerful, these governments or these very large corporations? And they seem like they're kind of on the same page when you hear that governments aren't signing on to these agreements. But if ideally the governments were all in lockstep and were not beholden at all to oil and gas industries' interests, could they roll back the 120% ramp up we're talking about? Is it in their power to do so?
They could. And I think that the momentum is actually there from a number of countries, especially the EU, but also from the finance sector. What I saw and what gave me hope at COP25 in Madrid is that the finance sector is moving. The European Investment Bank has said, no, we're not going to invest at all in the expansion of oil, gas, and coal, because it's, you can't keep building the bad stuff and saying you're going to create a different world. That's what AXA Insurance has said. That's what the World Bank has said.
Even Goldman Sachs, right, just became the first major U.S. bank to stop funding Arctic drilling and is pulling back on coal, right?
It's partial. That doesn't mean that they're not going to fund the massive expansion of oil and gas in the Permian Basin in Texas or tar sands in Canada. So that's only partial, but it's a start.
It's a start.
So we're seeing this movement in the finance sector. We're definitely seeing an increased level of ambition and closing those loopholes in the new EU proposal in front of Parliament for the new EU Green Deal. And so there's movement. New Zealand, for example, has said, no, they're not going to do any more offshore drilling. Costa Rica has said, no expansion of oil and gas. So has France. So we're starting to see this movement, but it's like there's no, the text and the conversation has been in some ways so warped over 30 years that there's no way to stop the lock-in of production underneath the Paris Agreement. So there's a group of us from around the world, economists, lawyers, climate policy experts that came together last year to try and figure out what to do about this. And this week, we went live with a new proposal. You can find it at fossilfueltreaty.org. We are calling for a parallel agreement, so not to replace the Paris Agreement, but an emergency treaty, a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, which is an initiative to phase out the production of fossil fuels and fast-track solutions, because climate change, like nuclear weapons, is a major global threat. And we need bold action now. And we know we need to very quickly negotiate about stopping the production of fossil fuels and creating a just transition. But there's so many countries that are too heavily dependent. We can't leave anyone behind. And so negotiating on a new treaty, a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, allows us to create a global just transition plan, allows us to help countries so that they're not pushing their economies deeper into the hands of the oil and gas industry at this moment in history. Because the fact is, we have the solutions. We have the technology.
Inside in the days of 39. Oh, please leave the Vendana open. Frederico lockers dead and gone. Bullet holes in the cemetery wall. The black car of the Guardian of the Beer. Spanish bombs on the Costa Rica are dying in on the DC-10 tonight. Spanish bombs, you have to get a Benito. Yes, the Quena, oh my God, a thong. Infinito, just the Guerra, oh my God, it's all Spanish weeks in my disco casino. The freedom fighters died up on the hill.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Zipporah Berman. She's the International Program Director at Stand.Earth. So next year in Glasgow, Zipporah, when the world governments meet again for COP26, we'll know if we're about to embark on another 4 years of Donald Trump being the president of the United States. Maybe you can kind of give us a preview based on his reelection or the election of his opponent and what that will mean for you and your colleagues as you gather in Glasgow in 2020.
I think if we have a progressive administration in Washington, it changes everything. It would have tipped the balance of power this week in Madrid. The fact is that the U.S. bolstered the fossil fuel interests in Brazil and Australia in holding back negotiations. And, you know, if the U.S. were to align with the EU, even with Canada to a certain extent, many other countries, the African nations, the island nations, I think China would fall into line, and there's no way that Australia and Brazil at that point can hold out. So we could see an emergency increased ambition agreement in Glasgow. I think we would start to see negotiations on the fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty as well. I think that we might actually have a chance. And right now, every ton matters. So every day matters. If Donald Trump is reelected in the United States, then things are going to get ugly pretty fast, because people are getting desperate. You saw it in the halls of Madrid last week. You know, Australia's on fire. California has been on fire this year. The what people are living, millions displaced this year. More people lose their homes as a result of climate change now than war. And I think that if we don't see movement, if we don't have a more progressive government in the United States that recognizes the emergency that we're in and climate change, then we're going to start to see bilateral discussions. I think we're going to start to see trade sanctions. I think we're going to start to see a number of countries joining together to make their own agreements. And I think that the finance sector is going to start weighing in hard. And regardless of who is president, money talks. And right now, solar and wind are already cheaper than coal around the world, and they're dropping fast. And it's not like the price of oil has been very stable. So I think there are moments in history when things get unstuck. And I think this is one of those moments, regardless of what political, what administration we see in Washington. We can no longer afford as a global community to ignore what's happening to our climate. And I think this non-agreement that happened this week in Madrid has scared a lot of people. So I think we're going to see some new and potentially creative solutions.
She's the International Program Director for Stand.org, Zipporah Berman. Zipporah, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Willie Bobo, Van Morrison, and The Clash.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.